I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. President Trump has reportedly discussed with his advisors about whether to grant preemptive pardons for his three oldest children, his son-in-law and advisor Jared Kushner, and his attorney Rudolph Giuliani. The Times reported that he was concerned Biden's Justice Department might investigate their behavior after Trump leaves office. Trump has also said he has an absolute right to pardon himself. Our guests, Jack Goldsmith and Bob Bauer, who served respectively in the Bush 2 and Obama administrations, write in their new book, After Trump, that the president has violated numerous norms of the office. He refuses to acknowledge that Biden is the president-elect, making baseless claims about voter fraud. He never released his tax returns, called on the Justice Department to prosecute his political opponents, and mixed private business with his role as president. Goldsmith and Bauer join us to talk about reforming the executive and how it has grown more powerful in recent years, even before Trump. Bob Bauer joins us by Skype. He was White House counsel from 2009 to 2011. He's professor at New York University Law School, currently on leave to work as a senior advisor to President-elect Joe Biden. And Bob Bauer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
Nice to have you with us. And Jack Goldsmith is a professor at Harvard Law School, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He was head of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel from 2003 to 2004. And Jack Goldsmith, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Well, as I mentioned in my introduction, and it's true that Trump has not accepted the results of the 2020 election, let me begin with a montage of previous presidents and previous presidential candidates on the transfer of power: Bush 1, Al Gore, Bush 2, Obama, and Hillary Clinton. Can we hit that clip, please?
I just called Governor Clinton over in Little Rock and offered my congratulations. He did run a strong campaign. I wish him well in the White House.
What remains of partisan rancor must now be put aside, and may God bless his stewardship of this country.
This peaceful transfer of power is one of the hallmarks of a true democracy, and ensuring that this transition is as smooth as possible is a priority for the rest of my presidency.
My number one priority in the coming 2 months is to try to facilitate a transition that ensures our president-elect is successful.
Last night, I congratulated Donald Trump and offered to work with him on behalf of our country. I hope that he will be a successful president for all Americans.
Bob Bauer, I want to begin with you, but Jack Goldsmith, I want to hear from you as well. If President Trump never accepts the results of the 2020 election, does not attend the inauguration, and I think there's a good chance those things will not happen, how much has he damaged the presidency?
In my view, he shattered a critically important norm. That isn't to say it won't be restored and that future presidents absorbing the lessons of this bitter experience now won't revert to the norm. I hope they do. I suspect they will. But it is just hard to underestimate the significance of an American president behaving this way, not simply refusing to concede, but launching an all-out assault, an all-out rhetorical assault on the election, making baseless claims of fraud, authorizing one lawsuit after another. He's lost a total of 43 baseless lawsuits since the election was decided, and there are more lawsuits filed either by his campaign or his allies virtually every day, and he just continues to lose. But the lawsuits are simply an aid to this overall messaging that at least some substantial portion of the public that supported him should not accept the results of the election. That's extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary, and very damaging.
Jack Goldsmith, let me add to that. President Trump called the Speaker of Pennsylvania's House of Representatives two times last week, making a request to essentially reverse the results of the election in Pennsylvania. Joe Biden won by something like 88,000 votes. How unprecedented is that?
It's completely unprecedented. There's never been anything like that, at least not in recent history. And I would just add that it's kind of what Trump has done after the election, since the election, is kind of in a nutshell what he's done for 4 years, which is elevate his own personal interests over the interests of the country and the democracy. What he's done is exploit parts of our constitutional system that are hard to regulate by law. It's hard to regulate by law what he's been doing, which is lying about the results and not coalescing around the results. So in a sense, it's, I think, the most damaging and maybe despicable thing he's done in 4 years, but it's kind of typical of the other things.
Well, let me pick up on that, and I'll start with you, Jack Goldsmith, and go to you, Bob Bauer. I mean, it is interesting that the Trump campaign has largely lost in court, whether it's a local court or at Pennsylvania Supreme Court, for instance. Federal judges as well have ruled against the campaign. Can we say, Jack, that the system, or at least part of the system, is holding?
Yes, I actually think this is a very important point, and again, it leads to a more general point about the Trump presidency. It's been a very scary time, but it's also a time in which we can say that the institutions concerning our democracy and electoral transfer, under unprecedented and indeed unimaginable pressure by the strongest institutional player in the country to corrupt the system, it looks like it's failing, and it's failing because actors at the state level and the federal level, Republican and Democrat, are resisting. So in some sense, Trump himself has obviously completely violated the norms, but the system so far amazingly seems to be holding. We shouldn't be complacent, of course, and not being complacent is one of the reasons the system is held. But I do think there's reason to think that under this unprecedented pressure, we seem to be reaching the right result nonetheless.
But I wonder, Bob Bauer, you know, what Giuliani, for instance, said at the Lawn Garden Center in Philadelphia and what he has said or tried to say in a U.S. Court. Which one has bigger sway with the public?
There is a segment of the electorate, apparently, if public credit, are actually swayed by these arguments. People like the ones who showed up armed with bullhorns screaming obscenities outside the House of the Michigan Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson. There's a significant percentage who now have doubts about the outcome of the election. That is a significant percentage of the Republican Party electorate that Donald Trump obviously is speaking to successfully. And it does give me, I totally agree with everything Jack has said. I think it has been extraordinary. Some of these judges, let's keep in mind, who have rendered the biggest body blows to Trump's legal case have been Trump appointments and have said very harsh things about the cases that were brought before them and about the claims made by his lawyers. And one really has to tip one's cap to them and to election officials like those in Georgia who have stood up to this pressure. So I think that's really remarkable. I do worry that over time, particularly as the rhetoric becomes more violent and has the effect potentially of cowing election officials, that this is going to take a real toll. And we just have to worry that the next time around, we might not be so fortunate.
Well, I wonder, to you, Jack Goldsmith, I was reading, I think 27 Republicans in Congress have acknowledged that Joe Biden is the president-elect. Obviously, that means most Republicans elected in the U.S. Congress have either not accepted it or are unwilling to say it. What does that say about our Congress?
Well, it says
and the Republican Party, frankly.
Yeah, it says that they are politicians and that Trump has a vice grip on the Republican Party. And it's not an admirable thing at all, obviously, and it contributes to the problems Bob is talking with. The real problems here are not that Biden is not going to be president on January 20th, but that a very large chunk of the Republican Party is going to view it as illegitimate, which will obviously affect his ability to govern in some sense. And the Republican Party in Congress is contributing to that, and they're doing so for political reasons. They fear retaliation if they cross Trump. They probably worry about the impact on the Georgia Senate runoff on January 5th. It is what it is, but it's not admirable.
To you, Bob Bauer, you're a senior advisor to President-elect Joe Biden. What can Joe Biden do to address the level of mistrust if people do not believe that he is, and there are 70 million plus people who voted for President Trump, if they do not believe he is legitimate, what can he say? What can he do to prove them otherwise?
He ran, as you know, on a platform of an urgent need to unite the country. He would sometimes refer to it as restoring the soul of the country. And he will continue to reach out to those voters and to the public, and he will continue to bring them the same message he brought throughout the campaign, which is that for the country to address the monumental challenges ahead and for the country to remain basically true to its constitutional spirit, we have to find a way to come together. And I don't think there's any chance at all, just, you know, speaking predictively here, the president-elect Biden now or when he becomes president will ever stop reaching out across the aisles. He was known for that in the Senate. He's known for that as vice president, somebody who really does believe that these differences have to be bridged. And I think he's just going to continue to work at it in every way that he can.
I mean, Jack, you and Bob represent two different administrations, the second Bush administration and the Obama administration. I mean, how unusual is it for people who probably view a lot of issues, which we will talk about from a different perspective, can actually come together and find some kind of consensus?
Are you talking about me and Bob or in general?
I am. I'm talking about you and Bob. Yes.
So I have to say, so when Bob and I started this project 18 months ago, we agreed that it would be useful to try to map out what the reform program after Trump should look like. We come at these issues somewhat overlapping perspectives from the government, but obviously different perspectives. And, you know, we weren't sure how much agreement we were going to be able to reach. And we were able to reach, we think, a pretty extraordinary consensus on the way ahead in terms of restoring accountability to the presidency, closing gaps in laws and norms. One of the principles that guided us in writing the book was to try to abstract away from the politics as much as possible, try to imagine a kind of restrict, if we were proposing a restriction on the presidency, would that be one that we would be happy with if it was a president that we hadn't, that we preferred in office? And if we argued for conferring a power on a presidency or a discretion on a presidency, would we be happy if that were being exercised by a president of the opposite party from the one that we're members of? And so basically, you know, we did try to abstract away from the politics and see what kind of consensus could be reached. And I think we did we were pretty successful in that.
Well, and Bob, we're almost up on a break here, about a minute or so away. So it is possible, I guess, to get the partisanship out of politics?
Yes. I actually think on the larger issues, it is possible to account for differences of opinion on policy issues and still on some of these larger constitutional questions and questions of norms, to reach an understanding about limits that each party ought to be willing to live with. The golden rule, as Jack mentioned, and as we articulated in the book, should we be able to agree that something that we want the other party to live with in the way of the restriction is a restriction just by logic that we should be willing to live with when we occupy the White House? I think if you look at it that way, there's ample room for a constructive conversation, rather than, you know, a one-way street in which each side always gets what it wants, the other side is denied everything.
Well, I do want to pick up on all these things, and I do need to take a very short break. That's Bob Bauer. He was White House counsel from 2009 to 2011 in the Obama administration. He's a professor at New York University Law School, currently on leave to work as a senior advisor to President-elect Joe Biden. Jack Goldsmith, professor at Harvard Law School, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and head of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel from 2003 to 2004 under the George Walker Bush administration. They are co-authors of After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Our guests are Jack Goldsmith and Bob Bauer. We're talking about their new book, After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. You can also join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Well, let's talk about the pardon power of the presidency. And Jack, I'll turn to you, and I'll quote from your book. Many presidents on occasion have used the pardon power in controversial ways or in ways that seem politically or personally self-serving, but no other president has, like Trump, used pardon systematically to serve political and personal goals. Give us an example of that.
Well, two examples are the recent pardon of Michael Flynn and the commutation of the sentence of Roger Stone, both of whom were convicted or pled guilty to crimes growing out of related to the Mueller investigation, both of whom were closely connected to the president. And Trump is not the first president to pardon friends and cronies, but he's done so. The distinctive thing about Trump is that he's done so in a very high percentage of times. He's only issued about 45 pardons or commutations, and about 85% of those we describe as self-serving pardons, either a friend or someone he's on television or someone who serves a concrete political goal. So he has, as in other areas, exercised a traditional presidential power in a way that is abusive. He's just gone far beyond what other presidents have done.
Well, Clinton pardoned his half-brother. He pardoned Mark Rich. Ford, as we know, pardoned Nixon. George Herbert Walker Bush pardoned Caspar Weinberger after the Iran-Contra scandal. Let me turn back to you, Bob Bauer. Can the president pardon himself? Do we have Bob Bauer?
In our view, yeah, I'm here. I'm sorry.
Okay, that's okay.
The answer is no. I'm sorry, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Yeah, so in our view, there is a substantial question. It's never been addressed. The Office of Legal Counsel some years ago did suggest that self-pardon was not constitutional, but it was a very brief, somewhat cursory analysis. Doesn't carry a huge amount of weight, except it is the one occasion on which the executive branch lawyers have expressed a view on the subject. We propose in the book that Congress bar self-pardons, lay down essentially a constitutional marker. We think Congress can do that and that it could carry weight once the issue, once the battle is joined and the issue winds up potentially being litigated. And so our view is that that is the position Congress should take, and that's the right outcome.
Well, I guess speaking of norms and actually quoting that 1974 Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel memo said, under the fundamental rule, no one may be judge of his own case. The president cannot pardon himself. To you, Jack Goldsmith, the president of the United States says a lot of stuff, often does less than what he says. But even just saying that, I have the absolute right to pardon myself, or Article 2 of the Constitution says I can essentially do what I want. How does that violate norms?
Well, first of all, no president has ever uttered those words publicly, and it's not even clear it's been considered in private, the self-pardon idea. I mean, I'm not sure if that was a norm violation per se. There wasn't a norm against asserting broad Article II powers, verbalizing broad Article II powers in the past. But it is typical of the attitude Trump takes. And you're right, even though he doesn't always follow through on his threats and always follow through on his constitutional claims, it sends a message about how he views these powers. And in combination with some of the actions he takes, I mean, it's not a norm violation, but as it manifests itself, for example, in trying to comment on and trying to influence ongoing investigations about that involve him or his political officials, and, for example, conflict of interest and the like, it manifests itself in a whole variety of norm violations.
Well, I know the two of you have some disagreements about prosecuting a former president. And Bob Bauer, I'll give you a chance to weigh in on that. And as I said in my introduction, apparently the president is concerned that the Biden Justice Department might investigate the behavior of his children, or perhaps even him or his personal attorney. Can a president prosecute a previous president?
Well, it depends on what precisely the prosecutorial decision is all about. There are ongoing investigations that could involve the president. We certainly know of one which is taking place at the local level in Manhattan involving his financial affairs. There is a potential prosecution in the Southern District of New York aimed at the hush money questions that ultimately landed Michael Cohen in jail over payments made to women with whom Trump allegedly had relationships to silence them on the eve of the election in 2016. And of course, there are a whole host of questions about his conduct that were raised, say, in the Mueller report over commission of obstruction of justice, on which Mueller did not reach a conclusion, but the attorney general then stepped in and said he resolved them in Donald Trump's favor. I think that you have to separate out conduct before office from conduct in office, and then ask specifically what prosecutorial decision might in fact face an administration looking at the conduct of a prior administration. the larger point I just want to make, and then I'll just wrap the point up, is
sure.
we have law in the executive branch that presidents can be investigated but not prosecuted while in office. We have a norm, or at least some people believe it to be a norm, that they've derived from the Nixon-Ford episode, that in the interest of national unity and national healing, presidents should not be prosecuted as a normative matter when they leave office. And I don't think you can have it both ways, coming, if you will, have it coming and going, which is by law, no prosecution while in office, by norm, no prosecution when the president leaves office. And then you really do have a situation where the president is above the law. So I don't think we should take off the table that Donald Trump should be accountable in full for known misconduct that warrants investigation. I don't think the president, I think there are principles that argue pretty forcefully against it.
Let me give you a chance to weigh in on this, Jack Goldsmith. And let me quote something that Mueller said in his report. And this is a quote here. He said, if we had had the confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. Kind of a convoluted language there, but I think we know what Mueller is saying. What is your perspective on prosecuting a previous president for alleged crimes?
Right. So I think it's certainly allowed. There's nothing in the Constitution that prohibits it, and it's something that's within the Biden administration's discretion to consider. I think on pragmatic grounds, it's a bad idea. I think that despite Trump's clear malfeasance in office, it would be very, very difficult to actually prosecute him for a crime because, for example, the obstruction of justice issues that Mueller mentioned, there are a whole slew of constitutional questions about whether those prosecutions could succeed. I'm personally doubtful that they could. And if we think that those prosecutions aren't going to succeed, as I do, the costs of doing so to the normal transition in a democracy, to setting a norm of, to establishing a practice of one administration, looking at the last administration through the lens of criminal law, through the extent to which it would distract the Biden administration and the Biden Justice Department from its other goals, I think it would end up being much more costly than beneficial. And I think the idea that we could somehow vindicate the rule of law by doing this is probably not going to work out very well. And of course, it would just, in some sense, Trump would love it. It would keep him in the spotlight and maintain his kind of attention in the country. I just think on pragmatic grounds, not on any principled or norm-based grounds, but just on pragmatic grounds, I think it's imprudent to do so.
I mean, Bob, is there a danger of kind of, you know, lock him up, some of the chants that we heard at some of the Trump rallies, but applied to Trump himself?
Well, no, I don't think you want that. Absolutely do not want that. But I think this is going to require responsible attention and exquisite judgment and fidelity to the rule of law. It's not mob justice. But if we are aware, not because we look for it under every rug and every corner, but if we're aware of conduct that suggests investigable wrongdoing, I don't think we can turn a blind eye to it. I don't think the public overall, I mean, some members of the public would stand for it, but a very substantial portion of the public would not. And so I think it ought to be addressed, but I think it has to be addressed responsibly. It has to be a process that is pursued transparently and through regular order, through a Department of Justice that is permitted to operate in some sensitive area independently without any suggestion that it's being directed for improper political purposes or any purpose by the White House. But within those constraints on a transparent basis, I think it's I come out a little bit differently than Jack does. I think both our positions are somewhat nuanced, and the distance between us may be, as you read the book, is not as great as it may seem. And yet at the same time, I do believe there is a rule of law principle here to be vindicated.
Do you think the president has broken the law, Bob Bauer?
Well, you know, it's not up for me to judge that. You know, I think the question is whether or not the president has engaged in conduct that does, you know, for example, as a result of the investigation in New York or as a result of the investigation at both the federal and state levels in New York. The question is whether or not, fairly judged, there are facts that come to light that indicate criminal wrongdoing. And the question is, should it be pursued? And I think it should.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Bob Bauer. Also with us, Jack Goldsmith, and they have co-authored a new book. It's called After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. It's in many ways about some of the norms that President Trump has violated while in office and what can be done to restore the balance of checks and balances in our government. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Got a lot of comments here. Here's a tweet. Your guest mentioned institutions such as the court holding up under President Trump's attacks on democracy. What are their views on how the media has handled the last 4 weeks? And I guess I'll toss that to you, Jack Goldsmith, that the media is a huge institution. How do you think that the media has done? And as we know, President Trump, frankly, like other presidents, has been critical of the media, but he has gone so far as calling it the enemy of the people. Jack?
Yeah, it's very hard to comment on, for me to comment on how the media in general has done. I would say that it's performed really admirably in most respects and not terribly admirably in some, and it would take a long time to parse that out. I will say that Trump has attacked the media, and obviously in many unprecedented ways, he's done his best to destroy the kind of mainstream media's credibility. He has caused a splintering of media consumption along with social media and modern technologies that allow this. And so it's very hard to generalize because part of the, you know, we were talking earlier about how 80% of Republicans basically think the election was fraudulent. That is in part a result of the splinter media environment and the fact that different constituencies are receiving different, you know, news. And Trump has exacerbated that. And the media, frankly, in response to Trump, has kind of gone in that direction.
Let me read two comments actually about Newt Gingrich and Bob Bauer. I'll toss them to you. One from Christopher. He says, I worry we are now at a permanent impasse with the parties ever getting along. Has Trump permanently cemented in the negative and harmful tones that politicians like Newt Gingrich started years back? Difficult to imagine this ever-changing post-Trump. A comment from Doug. Contention between parties could normally be resolved by compromise for the good of a democracy, only up to the time when Newt Gingrich introduced a strategy of total attack. Is Congress or are the House and the Senate, Bob Bauer, sort of permanently at each other's throats? Or is there a golden rule that can be found there?
So I'm skeptical that there is any such thing as a sort of permanent feature of American politics. I think there are periods we pass through in which we see political change, and it's sometimes, as in the case that you cite, lamentable political change, deeply lamentable political change toward a polarized, uncompromising kind of political debate, where compromise is only possible if it is possible at all on what are essentially survival issues. Congress came together around one sort of stimulus bill in the wake of this pandemic and economic stresses that it caused, but then it couldn't, though negotiations continue, come together timely around another. So there's no question that we're passing through a very difficult period here. Gingrich, to me, while he certainly wasn't helpful in any way whatsoever, and there are many similarities in style and line of attack between him and Donald Trump, I view sort of more as a symptom, not as a cause, in the same way that I think Donald Trump is tapping into something in the political culture that is deeply unhealthy. I don't think he's making it worse. He's exacerbating it. He's exploiting it. In all those respects, I think he's behaving just beyond the pale. But I also think there are larger problems in the body politic. And so at every level, we just have to examine what's going on here, including, you know, just at the level of our communities and how they operate and the role of civil society institutions like, you know, our business communities, our religious communities, our educational communities. Something's not right here. And there's an active debate on what the sources of it are, but it's clearly now exacerbated in the age of Trump, severely exacerbated.
Jack Goldsmith, let me go back to you. And your book also looks back at President Nixon and some of the reforms that came after he left office. But interestingly, back in those days, Republicans went to the White House to tell the president, your time is up. It's time for you to go. We're not hearing similar, at least not out front where the rest of us can hear it, Republicans going to Trump and telling him it's over, it's time. it's time to give up. What does that
tell us?
We're not.
And one of the things it tells us is that, you know, reform circa 2021 of the presidency is going to be more challenging than reform of the presidency in the 1970s. As you alluded to, after Nixon left office, there was an extraordinary array of historic reforms to make the presidency more accountable, to buck up norms, to plug loopholes in the law in the 1970s that reformed the kind of post-Watergate, post-Vietnam, post-Church Commission presidency. Those rules and norms and laws worked remarkably well for 50 years. They failed largely, or not, I wouldn't say largely, but they've shown their deficiencies under Trump. Our book is in effect an effort to reimagine what the 1970s reforms should be circa 2021. And frankly, for the reasons you said, it's going to be more challenging. There's not the same level of cross-party consensus on these issues. It's not clear what the political lineup in Congress is going to be. There's no doubt that our politics are going to make reform harder, but we still think that a lot of progress can be made. There are areas of consensus on some of these reforms, and a lot of them can be implemented by the presidency alone.
Almost up on a break here. I'll go back to Jack Goldsmith. I mean, do we need a strong presidency?
Well, we think we do need a strong presidency. We don't. Our book is not about fundamentally cutting down the president and changing the constitutional scheme. We think there's a reason why the framers created a strong presidency. And so we don't argue for constitutional reform of the presidency. But we do think, we draw on Arthur Schlesinger Jr.'s famous formulation in the imperial presidency, which was basically the 1970s understanding of what was going on. We do think that while the presidency needs to be strong, he or she must be accountable to law, must be accountable to the public, and we've gotten far away from that during the Trump presidency, and that's basically what we're proposing to restore.
Well, I want to pick up on that after this very short break. That's Jack Goldsmith, who joins us along with Bob Bauer. We're talking about their new book, After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. Jack Goldsmith worked in the Bush 2 White House, Bob Bauer in the Obama White House, and he is currently an advisor to President-elect Joe Biden. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, talking with Jack Goldsmith and Bob Bauer. We're talking about their new book, After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. It's about how to keep executive power in check, reduce conflicts of interest, reform presidential pardon powers, protect the press and law enforcement, and safeguard democracy. I do want to get back to some of our listeners here, but let me just pick up on something and go to you, Bob Bauer, talking about the growing power of the presidency since those reforms kind of lost their power after Nixon. Is it that the presidents after Nixon were just intent on power grabbing, or was Congress ceding authority to the executive? How do we get to this point?
Well, it's an excellent question. It's a very complicated one. I mean, some of it has to do with the indispensable role of the presidency as a center of action or energy, an office representing the entire country that is in a position to do things quickly or in some cases or certainly decisively in ways that is much more difficult for a legislature to accomplish. Some of that, and very much related to that, is public expectation. We have a very strong view in the public that the president should be able to do all sorts of things. And by the way, some of those expectations are entirely unreasonable. And then you touch upon something else, is that every president comes to office with those heavy expectations, having made sometimes extravagant promises. Mm-hmm. And in order to meet those expectations and to execute on those promises, presidents will look for sources of authority to do what maybe an objective look at that authority should suggest they may not be so able to do at all. So all of those play into it.
Let me get Diana from Haverford to join our conversation. And Diana, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
I just wanted to say it seems that all of this is a ruse, this fake election, et cetera, is a ruse just to grift more money from people who can afford it. They've raised over $200 million so far from those that can't afford it. And the fine print on the distributions keeps changing. Right. And the GOP goes along because primarily they're cowards. And it also provides an excuse to possibly legislate restrictions on voting rights. And because if you look at what the Trumps are actually doing, not what they say, they're renovating Mar-a-Lago, they're renovating Bedminster for Trump and for Ivanka's family to move into. So it just seems like it's a very convenient but dangerous for election officials who are working very hard to do the right thing and to adhere to the laws, election laws and processes.
Diana, I appreciate your call. Jack, can you respond to that? And these are the and I get them, you know, all day long, the requests for money coming from the Trump campaign. Obviously, this losing record when it comes to court, is it just, are these just frivolous suits and orders to raise money for the campaign or the post campaign?
Well, I can't assess the motives, but but the lawsuits clearly have been losers. I think they've lost 40, as you say. Most of the lawsuits are frivolous, if not all of them. They've been rejected by judges left, right, and center. And I generally agree with the caller that it seems that here, as in during his presidency, Trump is kind of abusing power and looking out for himself at the expense of the country. I mean, it's, as I said earlier, it's more of the same. It is perhaps the worst thing he's done yet, but it's not that different from what he did during his presidency. And I think your caller's description of the state of affairs is largely accurate.
Well, let me pick up on that. And this is, I think the New York Times yesterday, and I'm quoting here, more than 200 companies, special interest groups, and foreign governments patronized Mr. Trump's properties during his presidency while reaping benefits for him and his administration. 60 of them spent $12 million at his properties during the first 2 years he was in office. And Bob Bauer, you and Jack Goldsmith talk about sort of mingling personal and presidential powers and business interests for President Trump, and also the fact that he has not released his tax returns. What can be done to reform that?
This is an area where we both believe that there's an opportunity once Donald Trump has left office for bipartisan reform. There has been for years until Donald Trump refused to release his tax returns, an expectation, a norm governing the release of those returns, and presidential candidates as well as presidents have done so. Donald Trump has not done so on excuses that nobody credits. And so there is, at this point, I think a clear need for legislation to require it. And we lay that out in some considerable detail. And then further to your point about his money-making activities, he's the first president to put together essentially a process for running the government and running a business at the same time, promoting his properties with visits, having taxpayer funds flow into those businesses. And we have detailed proposals for financial conflict of interest regulation of the president, which to this point has not been required because the norms were so active. But now it seems to us that they're required.
Well, and it's Jack, just going back to you want the IRS to release the taxes of presidents, not the presidents deciding whether to release his or her taxes, but that the IRS would make that decision. Can you speak to that?
Well, the IRS, it's not well known, but the IRS already does a mandatory audit of presidential taxes. And we do set up a process in case, so we believe that the law should demand that president disclose taxes. And if the president doesn't do that, we set up a process whereby the Treasury Department would be required to disclose the tax returns. And we also think that those audits that the IRS done should be made public. So all of these things are doable by law. All of these things are consistent with norms that presidents and parties have accepted for 50 years. So this is one area where we're hopeful that there can be a consensus after Trump on plugging this loophole.
I mean, Bob, are norms, are they elastic? I mean, and maybe do we need laws as opposed to norms to keep any president in check?
Mm-hmm. In some cases where norms begin to fail, if the underlying policies or objectives of those norms are really very important, and typically they then we should absolutely turn to legislation to accomplish what the norms no longer accomplish on their own. And the tax production is one, financial conflict of interest is another. And throughout the book, we try to identify this constant dialogue between norms and law, norms that can function, like, for example, within the Department of Justice to constrain politicized prosecutions, but law, where necessary, where the norms just can't do the work.
Well, even picking up on that, and Bob, I'll go back to you. And the president, before he was president, when he was a businessman, his lawyer was Roy Cohn. And he has made it very clear that that's how he views the attorney general and frankly, his Justice Department. How do we fix that?
We make a number of proposals that include both reforms that a president coming after Trump could institute as regulation within the executive branch. Those are important. Those internal regulations are important. We have codes of ethics and standards for prosecutions that can be bolstered significantly in a way that I think reinvigorates, and we both believe will reinvigorate the norm. There are some statutory steps that can be taken. For example, that an attorney general cannot be selected from the ranks of people who were officials who had responsibility and positions of trust in a political party supporting the president, or the president's campaign organization, or another political organization that supported the president. So there are a variety of ways that you can attack the problem. Another example, by the way, which is important, is some clarity about the way the obstruction of justice statute applies to the president. The president does have, obviously, responsibility for the operation of the Department of Justice, a significant amount of authority, can direct policies, can in fact set, if a president chooses to do so, can intervene and make prosecutorial or direct prosecutorial decisions. We have a norm that militates strongly against it. But presidents cannot, in our view, obstruct justice, and the law could be amended to make it clear in what ways they can't.
Jack Goldsmith, here's a question from Margaret. Could lawyers on Trump's legal team be subject to discipline or legal action for pursuing frivolous lawsuits and or misuse of public funds in those efforts?
I think it's hard to, this has been threatened, but I think it's hard to execute going after the Trump lawyers for the lawsuits they've brought. I don't believe that any of the lawsuits have yet, I might be wrong, Bob can correct me, been deemed frivolous under the legal standards for frivolity. And I'm not sure, I actually don't know about the misuse of public funds point. I haven't seen that point raised. But I'll say that for me, while the lawsuits seem frivolous, I think it would be also dangerous to not allow normal legal process to take place. It's clear that Trump has tried to abuse that process. It's also clear that the process has worked and has rejected his claims. And that kind of, in a way, gives legitimacy to the system, that he was able to bring all these lawsuits, that he wasn't prevented from bringing all these lawsuits, and yet they were all rejected. So I think it would be hard to do, and I'm not sure it would be prudent.
Well, here's a related question, Bob. I'll toss this to you. This is from Philip, who says, is it significant that the judiciary is the institution holding the strongest after the election, given the lack of impact by media scrutiny? But just, and I started with that question, but why do you think the judiciary has been so strong under various, frankly, attacks over the years?
Well, I'm not sure whether the caller is referring specifically to how well the judiciary has held up to these attacks on the electoral process post-election, just taking that as an example. But you're right. Throughout the administration, in a variety of cases that were important to Donald Trump and his administration, he ran into really extraordinary resistance in the judiciary. And his one-loss record in some areas of litigation are really unprecedented, meaning he lost a lot, just as he's losing a lot in this post-election period. And I think, you know, we should be very grateful for that. We should be grateful that judges appointed by both Democratic and Republican presidents do pay attention to the law. In the post-election period, as we mentioned earlier, Trump judges have expressed not just ruled against Trump, but have basically admonished the Trump campaign and its allies and opinions and in the courtroom for bringing baseless charges, meritless charges, in language that any lawyer would be embarrassed to hear from a judge in arguing a case for a client. And so that's something we should really treasure. And the hope we should all. even though both parties are anxious to control judicial appointments, that there would continue to be a good balance between the politics of those appointments on the one hand and the quality of the judges that are appointed. Because at the end of the day, when those judges put those robes on, that is the critical moment where they begin to move into a position where we hope that they exercise the kind of judgment we expect from our judges.
Jekyll Smith, I'm watching the clock here. I just want to put a couple of other things on the table. What can be done to protect a campaign or the country, frankly, from foreign interference?
Yes, so this is a really important point, and we've got several concrete proposals. Robert Mueller's special counsel report identified a number of gaps and loopholes in the law that allows a corrupt presidential candidate or to enter into basically a mutual aid agreement with a foreign government about influencing the election. We would just explicitly criminalize that. We just plug a loophole. We would also require campaigns to report to the FBI any contact from foreign states. This is an area that has not received enough attention from Congress, and the gaps are pretty obvious. And so we propose plugs to fill them, but there are clear legal steps that can be taken to kind of cut off those nefarious relationships.
But aren't campaigns supposed to tell the FBI if a foreign power or person wanted to influence their campaign? Aren't they supposed to do that, Jack?
Well, there's no legal requirement that they do so now.
Oh, there's no legal. Okay. So you would make that the law?
It would be required, yes.
What about opposition?
With penalties attached to not complying.
Right. What about opposition research? I mean, should that also not have foreign fingerprints on it? I'm thinking, frankly, of the Steele dossier. He's British. I mean, should we have outsiders doing research for campaigns? Jack?
Bob may be in a better position to answer this question than I am.
Okay, Bob, go ahead.
Well, no, as you recall, Bob Mueller did cite federal authority for the proposition that information of value to a campaign like opposition research is a contribution like any other. It's subject to contribution limits, subject to disclosure. But he was worried. He thought there was some ambiguity in the law and some constitutional questions. We believe that that should be very clear. It should be very clear that sort of support from a foreign source is a contribution. And because foreign nationals cannot make contributions in federal elections, it should be prohibited. There is a distinction between a foreign government providing that kind of information and purchasing services from vendors that are either, you know, foreign controlled, foreign corporation controlled or the like. There's an old opinion from the Federal Election Commission, for example, where there was information that a campaign wanted to purchase from a company in Canada that produced a certain kind of voting information. It made it available to everybody on a commercial basis. Mm-hmm. And that's not a contribution. That's a paid for arm's length commercial transaction. But where it's part of a political alliance, a strategic political alliance, and it's provided free of charge because the donating party is trying to help the candidate, well, that certainly should be prohibited.
We're almost out of time. And Jack, I hate to toss this at you with only 30 seconds. Should we make presidential lying against the law?
It's very hard. That's hard to do for a couple of reasons. I mean, the president's always tell fibs at the margins of political speech, and it's just very hard to regulate. And so I think that's hard to do. What you have to do is to control the consequences of lying in terms of the integrity of government as much as possible, and that's what we tried to do.
Well, we're going to end on that note. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Jack Goldsmith, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And you're very welcome. He's a professor at Harvard Law School, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and he was head of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel from 2003 to 2004 under the George W. Bush administration. Bob Bauer, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you very much for having us.
You're very welcome. And he was White House counsel from 2009 to 2011 under the Obama administration. He's a professor at New York University Law School, actually currently on leave to work as a senior advisor to President-elect Joe Biden. And their book is After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.